Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yeah, this podcast, I would like to introduce John Williams, J.W.
J.W.
Who was with Lone Wolf Management, which was ZZ Top.
I feel like I should insert a wolf howl there.
Go ahead.
Ow! My voice is a little hoarse today. Sorry.
Point Blank, Eric Johnson,
nice.
Van Wilkes. Am I missing anybody?
Yeah, J-Boy Adams.
J-Boy Adams.
Point Blank.
And we also managed Paul Rogers and Kenny Jones in a project called The Law.
Wow.
Which was a lot of fun.
So before we get started, I want to bring something up that I didn't say to JW because I wanted to just spring it on him.
Yeah, you're good for that.
Okay, so here's the deal. You know how, so JW and I and our wives and our children went on a skiing trip. And we went to Keystone to go on a ski trip.
Yeah.
And you know how the dynamics of different couples and then who knows what's going on. And I don't know if I was arguing with Charles. I don't know if he was arguing with his wife. I don't know what was going on. But there's all these dynamics going on. And then on top of it, he brings an advance of a brand new ZZ Top album that no one's heard.
Oh, wow.
I've got the advance of Are You Gonna Go My Way by Lenny Kravitz that no one has heard.
Nice.
So we were kind of swapping, you know, these new songs. But where I think I lost JW is when I was the first day of skiing, my body was so sore,
yeah,
right? My muscles.
Right.
So I'm putting this stinky ointment on my legs and on my ass and on my arms. And it smells terrible, but I'm sore. I'm sore from skiing. And I'm almost certain
it was Hot Shot. It was that stuff.
Oh. I'm certain.
Jockstraps is a prank.
And JW didn't say a word, but just his look is like, are you fucking kidding me? Are you really doing that?
Yeah, JW said, been gay, and Fred goes, not lately.
Oh, my God. So I had to get that out there, man. I am so thrilled to have you on our show. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
So you're in Nashville, is that correct?
I'm in Nashville. I've been up here for 15, 16 years now. 17. So, yeah.
So Nashville's kind of gone through the same thing Austin went through. There's a big skyline now. There's terrible traffic, and we feel like we're living on the West Coast.
Yeah, it's like everybody's lost their mind.
Well, and I met
until February, and then everything just comes to a standstill.
Yeah.
I met JW
when Warner Brothers transferred me in 1980 from Detroit to Houston, but I think I dealt with him a little bit because we had signed ZZ Top and there was no product out yet. And the reason Warner's was able to sign him is, didn't London release a greatest hits without your guys' approval, and that was a way for you to get out of that deal?
Yes, and there's a little story to that. I was, as your suggestion, I listened to Sig's podcast with you, which was just hilarious.
It is hilarious.
Sig the Punk.
Love her to death. I just love
Sig
her.
Sig the Punk.
She's such an awesome human being. At the tenure with London was really difficult because London was basically an American company. That was kind of a spinoff from British Decca. And Decca, I mean, they might have had the Stones for a minute over there, but they were a classical music company. The guy that ran London was a British gentleman who he was Sir Edward Lewis, and he never really got his head around American rock music. But he knew that there was such a, you know, with the Beatles and all the stuff going on, this was in the 60s now, there was something to this, and they needed to be in on it. So they had a presence in New York, and they hired a gentleman named Walt McGuire. Walt McGuire was a freaking awesome human being. He was in the 82nd Airborne, jumped into Normandy, just an an incredible man. Wow. Well, he took a liking to Bill. Bill was a promotion man. He worked for a one-stop out of Houston, and one-stops, for those of you who don't remember what that is, it was a company that represented a number of record companies. They carried maybe 20 or 30 different labels, and they would go into a radio station and have a stack of singles a foot high, just here, 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 this is great, this is great. Well, Bill was a promotion guy, and he carried London product. So he had an intro to Walt McGuire. Walt took a shining to Bill. Bill kept telling him, I got something really big working here. And so that's how he got into London. Well, London was never really had their feet on the ground. They didn't have a powerhouse distribution like WEA or Sony or, you know, the Columbia labels of the day. So they were all distributed through one-stops around the country. So he would always have difficulty getting product into stores and tracking it, and it was just the bane of Bill's existence to go into a market on a tour date and call around. And we would do it because one of my first jobs there was calling record stores and checking on product, and you would find there's no product in the market. What the hell, you know? Wow. We're coming in to a concert that's sold out, and there's no records for people to buy. It would just make him crazy. So that relationship was difficult. And even with big records like Tres Hombres, that's a diamond record. That record sold, you know, that wasn't diamond, it was Eliminator. Anyway, these records were platinum records ultimately, but they were very, very difficult to get product in the market. So it was a constant frustration. Toward the end of the term, after the Worldwide Texas Tour, Bill just kind of set back and was just, you know, he wanted to leave, but he had loyalty to Walt, and he didn't want to, you know, appear to be try to muscle his way out. But he just kind of laid back and figured that they were going to pull something after this very successful tour, and they put this Greatest Hits record out, which violated the terms of the deal, and boom, he was out of the deal. So he kind of allowed him to do it. It was a piece of their catalog that's eternal, and it was a great, you know, compilation of songs. But they did it without his permission, and he ended up on the technicality was able to walk.
So basically, he just sat back and watched them screw themselves.
Yeah, pretty much.
Exactly.
And then when I met JW,
very, very, very shrewd man, very, very shrewd businessman.
Right. So when I got to Houston, obviously this is where ZZ Top is based, mm-hmm. and JW was one of the first people I met beside Louis Messina. And I always got along so well with JW, and he was so excited to have a Warner rep because, like I had said in a further podcast, I mean, Louis had said, what did you come by wagon train? Because they hired me in January, and I moved there in June.
Right.
And they're like, come on, man, we have things to do. And JW was the same way. It's like, come on, man, we have stuff happening. I mean, we're about to release a Warner Brother record. Let's go. And it was a fun ride. So tell us, how did you even get started?
Oh, my goodness. I first met the guys in the band. They recorded their first two albums in Tyler, Texas, at a little studio called it was Robin Hood Bryan's studio in Tyler. And I was in a little local band. We opened at a teen club called, teen club, maybe 100 people could get in there. They would record in the daytime and at night play at this little, it was called the Lighthouse. I'm sorry, the Lighthouse. And it was owned by a guy that owned the local record store, and he would sell, you know, cassette players and 8-track tape machines. And then he had a little rack that he'd sell tapes and stuff. So he would play it. They would play at night for a couple of 2 or 3 nights there and make, you know, a couple hundred bucks, I guess. But they use that money to pay for the recording for the next day. So it was a real hand to mouth deal. So I met them there the first time, and this was right after the, you know, Billy had left the Moving Sidewalks and Dusty and Frank had left a band called the American Blues. I'd actually met Billy when he was in the Sidewalks at a teen dance in 1968 in Tyler, and so they were recording the first record. And that's where I first met them. And then I went off to college and went to Texas Tech. They were doing small theater dates, and they played a show there. I got to see them again. One of my best friends in college happened to be an artist, which was Jay Adams, that was managed by Bill in those days. And Jay said, you need to know this guy. And he was telling Bill this, you need to know this guy. And so when I got out of school in 74, I went to work for ZZ Top.
Wow.
I mean, I was a psychology major, and I went down there and I started tuning guitars. I mean, my mom and dad thought I had lost my friggin' mind, joined the circus, and, you know.
Joined the circus.
It's probably because you guys were hanging out at all those teen clubs, man.
So I met them that way, and then just, you know, became a, you know, member of their the road entourage. After a few years of that, Bill saw that I might have had some abilities elsewhere, and I started working in the office, you know, dealing with promoters and, you know, the marketing, advertising, and just kind of logistics of the, you know, the tour. Of course, we had other acts too. They were young and up and coming acts, and so they took a lot of time. But anyway, I became member of the staff in the office. After a few years, I was the vice president of the management company and ZZ's day-to-day guy and Bill's right hand. And, you know, it was almost 30 years, and it was just an amazing ride. I treasure every minute of it.
And what's interesting is they're just such a hard-working trio. And that documentary, yes. At least for me, JW, I love that documentary. I just thought it was so
me too.
Well done. It was so educational. It was everything about it I thought was fantastic. How about you?
Yeah. You know, guys, I watched that, and I was at times I was in tears.
I bet.
Just some of those special memories, and I was laughing my ass off, and then I was calling bullshit on that. That didn't happen in that sequence, guys. Come on, you know. They were when they were editing some of the stuff around, they were kind of missing some, you know, pushing some years around a little bit. But anyway, it was so beautifully done, and the historical footage there, you know, from the early, you know, late 60s and 70s in rural Texas.
Yeah.
I mean, whoever put that together was absolutely brilliant. And I thought the insights that you got to each of the three guys was so much more in depth than anything I'd ever seen.
And it was wonderful.
I sat through every interview they ever did until I left the company. I mean, I'm serious. And they were so articulate and so, you know, you learn something about the depth of their commitment to each other. It was, you know, my deal, you know, I was in management, or I was either with the crew or I was in management. And then, but to hear them express and the way they did their commitment to each other was just, it was so special. I mean, really. And at the end, you know, they had such, you know, Dusty, and they had such kind things to say about Bill, and who had passed by the time that documentary came out.
Wow.
Which was a loss to our industry. But I just thought it was so well done.
Happen to see the interview with Dan Rather that he did with Billy Gibbons on the big interview on Access TV? Have you seen that?
I haven't.
It is amazing. It's really good interview.
I have not.
It's great. You guys should check that one out, too.
Well, Rather is probably one of the best interviewers in the world.
So. Yeah. And doesn't he live here in Austin now?
I don't know where he lives, but I mean,
his daughter lives here, Robin.
I didn't realize what a huge music fan. I mean, he had, you know, Greg Allman before he passed away. He's just had so many musicians, and he just does really great interviews.
Yeah,
so you guys
should
check that out.
Well, so JW, what a rocket ride you were on. 30 years of a band that's fighting for airplay, fighting for a position in the, you know, in not only in the rock concert world, but airplay. Then all of a sudden, Warner Brothers signs them, which is powered up to deliver distribution, promotion, marketing at a level that was unparalleled, except maybe Columbia.
Right.
And then
I think it was even better myself.
Thank you. Thank you, being a Warner alumni. Thank you very much. But I do recall a story where George Garrity was my national rock guy, and he wanted to come visit me in Houston because I had just got there. And he said, hey, man, let's go visit Bill. So we went to Sherwood Forest. You know, it makes you feel like Robin Hood.
He lived in Sherwood Forest.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Well, that's the name of the street name of the house. That was a single-story ranch-style home.
Love it.
That they converted into offices. And Bill had collected all this crazy paraphernalia. So when you walked in his office, it was like a museum of knickknacks and gold records and God knows what all. And then he brought out what was the working artwork for, what's the album where they were in the West Texas sand dunes?
That was El Loco.
El Loco, because that was the record I worked the hardest on with ZZ Top because it had cheap sunglasses, it had Party on the Patio,
right.
Pearl Necklace, which isn't a piece of jewelry.
Really?
No.
I didn't know that.
which reminds me, JW, when you got the advances of some of this stuff before the rest of the world got it and you heard Pearl Necklace. What did you think?
It's really interesting. I'm glad you asked that question because it's a good one. Bill and the three guys would, for the most part, with the exception of Terry Manning, the engineer up at Arden, would have been the only people who had heard these songs, from their roughs to the little cassette tapes that the guys would work up when they were writing to. When they would go to Ardent and listen, when they would go up there, they would stay for months. They would move into the Peabody Hotel, and there was one point we had the biggest hotel bill of record in the Peabody until some Arab sheik came in there and stayed for a year. But went to his kid was in the hospital or something. But yeah, so there was always an event, and he would bring the staff in together. I'm getting a bunch of bounce back here, guys.
Yeah, we're getting a little bit of a pop, too.
Yeah. Are we good now?
Sounds like it's okay now.
Okay, cool. It was almost like it was a very special gathering. He would bring the staff in, and he would put a cassette in, and he would hit play, and he just wanted us to shut up and listen. And a lot of times they were roughs. They weren't quite finished yet. He knew what he was going to do to finish them off. But we would sit there and listen from start to finish of, the project. And some of these songs like Pearl Necklace, I mean, we were on the floor. I mean, I remember. Fred, do you remember it? Do you remember in his office he had that barber chair?
Yes, he had a barber chair. And then he also had the horse saddle.
Yes. So a lot of times when he had, six or eight people in there, somebody was sitting on the saddle. Somebody always took the barber chair first.
I love the barber chair.
The hot seat was a little couch that was sitting right in front of his massive and imposing desk. And anyway, so I was sitting in the barber chair. When that song came on, I fell out on the floor.
But that record was...
Guys, you are sick. This is awesome.
Right? And I remember going out and buying cheap sunglasses, like 100 pairs of sunglasses to give the radio while we delivered the record.
Great promotion, yeah.
So
yeah.
I never got a gold record for that. Can you tell RIAA to make me one and I'll pay for it? Because I felt like I had more fun busting that record out of Houston. And I got to tell you, JW, I had so much fun with you. You're such a good guy. We had a lot of fun. We had a lot of drinks, a lot of laughs. And the whole local promotion community in Houston, you were friends with everybody regardless of what record labels they work for. So, a lot of times when all the record people get together, we'd invite JW to come be with us, and we'd have happy hour or whatever. It was always a lot of fun.
And why don't we continue that today?
Is there record promotion people anymore? Is there expense accounts anymore?
Right.
It's a lost art. And you know what's so interesting, Fred? Bill was being a promotion guy. One of the first things I learned when I was working in his shadow was how much he respected and the relationship and the commitment that a national guys had for product and how, it's such a special, close relationship. I mean, these are lifelong friendships that, I mean, right now, dude.
Right now.
40 years since you and I met.
Yeah.
We talked today like we hadn't, we hadn't seen each other in a long time, just like we saw each other last week.
Yeah, and I think the only time you ever got mad at me was when I put this stinky ointment on my legs when we went skiing together in Keystone. When he looked at me like, are you fucking out of your mind?
I don't blame him for that.
I had to ride on the ski lift with you all the way to the top.
Oh, man.
But I got to tell you, man, I had the advance of Lenny Kravitz, Are You Gonna Go My Way? And do you remember what you had? I can't remember.
Gosh.
Transformer, I can't remember, but we had a blast listening to
it
these
might have
advances.
Been, would it have either been Afterburner or Recycler?
Oh, you know what? I bet it was Recycler is what I think it was.
Yeah. Hey, JW, I wanted to kind of follow up a question we had with Sig, who worked in the office there. And
is it about the rooster?
Well, not about the rooster, but it's about when they made their transition to video and, of course, became MTV Darlings. I mean, you know, she was saying the band wanted to do it and Bill was a little apprehensive. What was your feelings on them going to video?
Well, obviously, it's, you know, it was history. They recreated themselves for for a third time.
Right.
They were that, you know, American blues band that didn't want to be a Southern rock band for the London period. And then when they reinvented themselves with, they're joining with Warner Brothers and then there again with the MTV generation, it was the third time. They morphed three different times. And so few artists get an opportunity to do that. I mean, the longevity that offered them, it's just phenomenal. It worked out that way for a number of acts, but a lot of them it didn't. It was, you know, they were one hits and gone, and
right.
they didn't look good on TV, so they never got another shot unless it was a concept video. But they were, their sense of humor, the working with Tim Newman, who did the who did the Sharp Dressed Man and Legs and all that. I mean, his sense of humor and theirs just meshed perfectly. It was so cool. And just the culture of Warner Brothers, it was into that. And Bill was he was hesitant. And he was I recall in Sig's interview with you guys, you know, he was very, very – the Mystique thing was very important to him because he worked with so many artists as a promotion guy that were so overexposed that there was nothing special about him. Every time you turn around, here's this guy on TV, or here he is over there, here he is there, and he's a supermarket tabloid guy, mm-hmm. and he didn't want that for those guys. He wanted people to be talking about them as opposed to them talking about themselves, and he accomplished that. And he very reluctantly allowed him, but you know that's show business on his part too. He got to make him want it and really make you work for it, kind of thing. So. He was resistant because it was a medium that he wasn't real sure at the beginning that it would take off. And there was a lot of people in the industry that didn't know that it would explode like it did. But it did. And
Boy, did it ever.
And they were right place at the right time. And it was a perfect, like I say, a
perfect way
for their third incarnation, you know.
Yeah.
So was there any rituals they had, like on their tour buses, that you could tell any funny stories about the tour buses or traveling to different countries around the world or anything that you can kind of grab onto to share with our listeners?
You know, there was one thing that was so cute that every show I ever saw them do, and there were thousands of them from, you know, the early 70s to
30 years
when I left, you know, that many years later. It didn't matter how pissed off they were at each other. And these guys were friends. They loved each other. And they do to this day. I mean, they're brothers. They love each other. They get mad at each other like any brother will. Their relationship's longer than 90% of the marriages in the world.
Right.
You know, come on, think about it. Think about it.
Yeah.
From the 60s to now, I mean, gosh, 50 years. They had this thing that they called the tweedle. And it would be, it didn't matter how pissed they were or what they were doing or what mood they were in. They would all converge, the three of them. And they had this thing where they kind of like twitched their fingers and they would touch each other's fingertips. And then they would do this kind of like doing a locker room, like, hey, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it was just so cool. And it was so unconscious. They'd be walking and they'd turn around and without even thinking about it, just there it was, boom.
Twiddle their fingers.
That's what they did the moment before they walked out into the lights. So.
And then the thing that the audience doesn't really understand that you would, I would, L.A. Loy would, is when you walk on that stage and the roar of the crowd is intoxicating. I mean, the hairs in the back of my neck would stand up when I'd be on the side of the stage and the band would hit and the lights go on and the roar of the crowd and they plug in and strum a chord and the power of that chord.
Yeah, it's exhilarating.
So anything about Under Countries, any funny stories about them in Copenhagen or, you know,
Amsterdam
or
well, the Bulldog Lounge and
the Bulldog Lounge.
Yeah.
There, you know, guys, there's a statute of limitations on just about. There's still there's too many kids and too many moms still around.
Right, right. Totally get that.
But I'll say this. They've we toured the world. I mean, from Africa to Russia, Scandinavia, Far East, Australia, just so many different continents. And the way that they developed their following in each of those countries was just like they did in the United States. They started with small venues. They might play over here, guys, and when they first started in the late 60s and early 70s, they might do 20 markets around a major market without going in, like, say, Houston, okay? They'd play Beaumont. They'd play Huntsville. They'd play Galveston. They'd play all around Houston. And then building up to that point to where they could go into Houston and know that they were going to just knock it down, not, you know, they'd sell it out.
Right.
It was very strategic. It was very planned. It was Bill's genius of how do you encircle an area and then take it.
Nice.
The Northeast, he did it. And that's the same way Punch did it with Seeger.
Right,
you know, Fred.
Right. Punch did
it was very meticulous. There was this beautiful. I hope it's still around. I don't know who has it. Maybe one of Bill's nephews or his brother-in-law. Maybe somebody has it. But there was this big Rand McNally map of the United States, and it was massive. It was like 6 feet across, 4 feet high. One of the biggest ones I've ever seen. And he had a pin in every city that they had ever played.
Wow!
And it was so amazing to see. And he would do different colors, like, you know, certain year or whatever. But anyway, you could just see the ring around a major market, how he would surround it, and all of a sudden, boom. And then, you know, obviously you're playing the majors from then on out. But it was so meticulous at how he developed this. And they played, man, they would play gigs in some of these little towns, and it'd be the bartender and the sound guy, you know. There was one, I think you saw it in the documentary, where they were either, it was a teen club in Beaumont or something, or Galveston, somewhere. There's one kid there.
One
guy.
Yeah. And they played to him. They played their set to him.
This guy said, oh, man, sorry, you know, I guess, you know. He said, no, we're going to play. And they played the whole show, and they bought him a Coke after the show.
And this right here is why the Promotion Man podcast is so funny to me, because the audience gets to hear these really great stories about how a band is developed. And there is a genius to a guy like Bill Hamm and a rhyme, a reason of why he did what he did.
Right.
You know, so all the gold and platinum records you've got in your days with the band, is there one in particular that you look at and go, God, I just love this one?
I think it's a gold record from Ireland.
Really?
It's just so odd, you know. I mean, there's so many of them, and you know, they're all so special, guys.
I know, right?
First off, it was a very Bill was very, I wouldn't say picky, but very conservative about. He didn't just hand those out. You know,
I know. I don't have one.
It was the guys in the office, and you know, they would obviously, you know, make him one. I'm sure the engineer would get one. Arden Studios would get one. But he was very, very conservative. When you got one of those, you know, it was a freaking honor.
Wow.
I mean, it was an honor. Do you remember that, Fred? Do you remember in Miami when they came down and presented gold records to all you guys?
I had already left the company. But I do have to tell you, when Bill moved to Austin, him and I got together because I've been in real estate now for 20 years, and he wanted to talk to me about some real estate questions. And we had the most wonderful time reminiscing about our days together at Warner Brothers. And when you walked into the building, which is in the Texas Hill Country, just outside of Austin, and part of Austin proper, and the elevator shaft that went to the second and third floor in the lobby was gold records from the very ground all the way to the ceiling, and he made them to where they touched, the frames touched each other in uniform.
Holy cow.
It was just nothing but gold and platinum records from all over the world, just like JW said, like
That's
Ireland
awesome.
And whatever.
Very cool.
I should have begged him for a gold record in his office. I said, I'll pay for it. I'll buy it.
I remember when we built that office out, and that was such a cool thing to do. We remodeled that whole entrance area, and then got this really cool framer. I can't remember the kid's name, but he was just there, a little Austin artist. And I called him and said, do you frame gold records? And he says, oh, I have. I said, well, could you come out to the office? So he comes out.
No, he's going to do 100.
He says, what are we talking about? I said, well, we've got about 75, 80 records that we want to frame. And he looked at me like his jaw dropped. I mean, he's like, Christmas,
yeah, right.
Yeah,
he did such a great job, and he had to do it to where people that came into the building couldn't pull them off. So it's one interlocking piece of art, the frames from the very floor up to the third floor level.
Nice.
Awesome,
you can't, you cannot pull them off. I mean, it'd take a crowbar, you just tear them all to pieces.
Nice.
But he did this beautiful, just a work of art, what he did. It was just such a great job. It's a really beautiful testament to their career and to Bill's career, you know?
Yep. So when you left Lone Wolf and you moved to Nashville, tell us where your career went from there.
I left Lone Wolf in 2003, and I started, I opened Riverbend Center as a performing arts center there in Austin.
Yeah.
It's on the campus of Riverbend Church, and so it was an interesting project. I had some really cool clients at the Austin Symphony. I did their pop series there and their Christmas shows, and a lot of touring acts, a lot of special events, a lot of speaker series, a lot of corporate meeting kind of things. It was a really beautiful, it still is, it's a very beautiful building. And then I picked up a couple of management clients in Nashville, and I was kind of commuting back and forth. And met this pretty little blonde gal, and she took my heart, and I ended up moving up here. And then within about a year, I was offered the opportunity to be the day-to-day manager for Trace Atkins. And Trace and I had about a 10 or 11 year run.
He's a good guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have a lot of commonality to us. He was from Northeastern Louisiana. And I'm from East Texas anyway. So we grew up behind the Pine Curtain. So, you know, even being 10 years older than him, I was kind of like his older brother, and he's just a stubborn old country boy, but such a voice. And we had a lot of things that we both shared our interest in, and, you know, USO, Wounded Warrior Project, doing a lot of stuff for the military. I'm an Army dad, so it's very personal for me.
Yeah, that's
cool. We did 12 USO tours, Afghanistan, you know, Kuwait, Iraq, Bahrain, the Pacific Rim. All of us, but we've been shot at a bunch of times. It's been a very, very interesting time together.
JW's son is special ops and has been in the... Yes. Services, how long did you say?
He's been in for 16 years now.
Wow. Jeez. Yeah.
That's cool.
He does things he can't tell JW what he's doing.
Right. That's why he's in the special ops.
Yeah. We learned over the years a language where we can kind of talk between, you know, he's not really telling me anything, but I understand what he's saying. Sometimes I just don't tell me this. I did get to, here's another thing, guys. I got to see him while he was in Afghanistan. We were on a tour over there, and he shows up walking onto the airplanes. We landed in Bagram in the middle of the night, and it's just, oh my gosh, you know. Next to watching his birth, it was the coolest thing in my life.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. So then you went on, and you're with Michael McDonald. Is that true?
Yeah. Trace decided to leave Vector, the management company that I was with. And so there I am, actually without an act. And within a few months, there was an opening in Michael McDonald's organization. He was also managed by the same company. And so since November of 18 up until February of this year, I've been working with Michael, one of the coolest, nicest gentlemen you'll ever meet in the world. He's just the kindest, most, you know, decent human being.
He's just a good guy. So my story about Michael is, obviously, when Michael joined the Doobie Brothers, It took their sound to a completely different direction. And the Doobie Brothers were already a very, very powerful outfit that had a lot of hit songs before Michael. But when Michael came in, he brought some songs that turned out to be huge. And we won, you know, Grammy for Minute by Minute. But then, if you listen to Michael's voice, it's very rich. It's very almost urban sounding.
Unique.
So our Warner Brother Urban Department encouraged him to do a solo record.
Right.
And when he did the solo record, they delivered it to Urban Radio.
Huh.
And I always had an urban counterpart, an R&B counterpart. So in Houston, my guy had gotten ill about. So I picked up on the slack and I started going to his radio stations. And so Michael came into town and we went to the biggest radio station in Houston called Magic. It was the urban station. And we had a wonderful time. They interviewed Michael, and like JW said, he's just a wonderful guy. But when we got out, this is back in the day when there was payphones. And one of the things that radio would do is they would monitor how a song or album was selling, and they also monitored what if people were requesting it on the request line.
Right.
And if it was requesting and selling, it would continue to go up the charts. But if they ever lost sales or requests, they would look at it and start moving it downward and eventually off the playlist.
Yeah.
So we come out of the Magic parking lot, and it's a major road, and I see two payphones right across the street. So I just drive my car right to the payphones.
I
always had an ashtray filled with quarters. And Michael goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "Are you kidding me? I'm going to call and request your song right now." And he looks at me and he goes, "Can I do it too?" And I go, "Yeah, here's another phone. You know, the minute I hang up, you dial."
Right.
So we both requested his song on that radio station, and I just always thought that was the most endearing, you know, story about him.
That's cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, that was a true story. Well, how would you like to wrap up this? Do you have any go-to story that when you're drinking some scotch at a really fine steakhouse and people go, "What was it like for you to work with ZZ Top?" and you pull this one out of your back pocket?
You know, I'll tell you what, there's so many people that over the years I've been blessed to get to know that have become lifelong friends, that some of them, Freddie, you know, like you, that I haven't seen in years, but I hear your voice and it's like we've never yesterday morning.
I know.
We've never left, you know.
I know.
I've been so blessed for all these years to be able to do something that I love and to make, you know, my dad always told me, he said, "You find something you love to do for a living, you'll never work another day in your life." Well, that's right. What it's been like.
Yeah.
And it's been such a blessing to, you know, to be a part of that, whatever small part it was, to be a part and experience that with those guys. I mean, I was not up there on the stage with them. It wasn't about me. It was about them. And everybody in their team was like that as well. It was selfless. We're there for them. We're there for Bill. And then, you know, the other acts that I've had the good fortune to be associated with, like with Trace and with Michael, you kind of have to have a servant's heart to do this. And, you know, promotion guys are like that too. They're, you get so excited and so passionate about this record. And then, you know, you live and die every 7 days when you know, that report comes out and that chart comes out. And what did I do? Did I make enough calls? Did I push them? And we used to make calls until 9 or 10 o'clock at night calling radio stations. And sometimes, you know, Russ Thyred or Garrity would call Bill the next day, "Would you please stop calling these radio guys at home?"
that is so true. And here I look at L.A. Lloyd, my buddy.
Yeah.
And I don't even know how many times he threw me out of the station because I pushed him too far. I pushed him beyond his limit of what he was willing to take from me as a PD and a promotion man.
Yeah.
But that's true.
I don't think I'm the only one either, though.
Probably not. I think you're probably not.
But you know, like that is true.
Be able to work with some of the most amazing people in your life, be a part of this. It's just it's just a blessing, you know. And you look back and think, wow, I got to do that. I got to be a part of that. I got to see that. The people that you meet along the way, the events that you're a part of, the concerts, the audiences, the, you know, history. What's in history being made, you know?
Yeah.
The things you're able to do that most people can't even imagine, you know? Yep.
Well, we're all kind of grieving the death of Eddie Van Halen, who passed away yesterday. We're October 7th of 2020 in this interview, and we were able to do a really nice tribute, two-hour morning show tribute this morning on KLBJ FM in Austin, Texas, about Eddie. But you had some run-ins with him as well, didn't you?
A number of them, but the coolest one was back in, between DeGuayo and El Loco. Gibbons had developed with a guy over in Austin mini size electric guitar, and it was called the Chiquita. You remember what it looked like?
Yeah,
it's a little travel guitar, right? And there's been several different things, you know, people have tried them since then. But he gave Eddie one of those, and I remember backstage, it was at Azizi's show, the LA Sports Arena. Eddie was there, and Gibbons had given this to him a couple days before, and Eddie was so excited. He was just like this little kid, like, man, I can't believe this. He said, I took it to my tech, and we worked on this, and they were still working the kinks out of how it, you know. Gibbons actually had one that he played on stage, and it was pretty crude, you know, pretty funky, but to do the song, I think he did Hippie Pad with it. It was one of the opening songs of that tour. And Eddie was just like a little kid. He was just so, I mean, first off, Billy Gibbons gave him a guitar, and he was just thrilled to the moon. But such a nice guy, and I mean, it just broke my heart to hear this.
I know.
Yesterday.
I wonder if that's where the idea of the song Little Guitars came from on Diver Down.
I don't know.
No.
But that doesn't surprise me.
And I think Eddie actually had one made similar to it with his kind of setup on it. You know, he was the faster and lightning stuff, and Gibbons was a blues player, so it's much, much different feel technique there.
Buddy, thank you for being a part of this show. It's so great to talk to you again, and next time I'm in Nashville, I'm looking you up.
Thank
you for being a part of the Promotion Man podcast.
Road trip, friend.
Yeah. Yes.
Guys, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
All right, see you.
See you, man.
Adios.